House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. And we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3630. So if the members see, we are considering the Dash 2 amendments today. We talked somewhat about the concepts in the Dash 2 amendments yesterday. So we would like to, and of course we've reviewed the Dash 1 amendments already, which essentially replaced the bill. So if we could have Chris Ambrose isn't here yet. Uh-oh. You want to sit in for him? No.
Well,
so,
if you Andrew just want to deal with the Dash 2s, I think we can probably get.
Okay, well, let's get started, and you know, I want to make sure we get through this. So, if the department can come up with whoever they like to have join them.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lou Savage, Department of Consumer and Business Services. We've done this by committee so far, so I'll have three of us up here. The Dash 2s are really not very different than the Dash 1s, and we'll try to go through those for you. We spent some time this week kind of cleaning up a couple of the issues, and I'll let Andrew go ahead.
For the record, Chair Holdy, members of the committee, thank you. Andrew Scholl, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Product Consumer Protection Section. We'll start off by going in order. So I've got the first part. The first primary change, as you know, we discussed yesterday, was a revision to the definition of foreclosure consultant, which specifies the intent of the larger work group in drafting the definition, that a foreclosure consultant has to expect or take compensation from the homeowner. And, of course, this relates back to a couple of days ago, the real estate investors who were testifying. These folks make their money on a second sale of the home. They typically, or at least as the facts were presented, don't involve lease buyback options with the original homeowner, and they don't make their money off of the homeowner. The next item is the issue we discussed about net proceeds. And Lou, what section?
Section 9, page 20.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Bonamici. The net proceeds definition has been exchanged for a phrase, equity recapture. And some in the industry might be able to speak on that more later, but essentially net proceeds has a meaning in the real estate and title world, and it ran the risk of causing some issues in terms of the standard sort of accepted belief of what net proceeds were. So the equity recapture sets forth essentially what those items are. This is important because in an equity purchase, the original homeowner takes a lease buyback option. If they don't exercise that lease buyback option, the home is typically subsequently sold. What this statute provides is that a certain amount of the equity captured in that second sale then go back to the original homeowner. And I'm going to turn over the foreclosure notice revisions to Lou and Keith Carnes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
I am so sorry that I was late because I had to carry another bill in session, but have y'all gone through this section by section? It's making me crazy. I'm sorry. I'm not
okay.
That
we, they were just reviewing. We had done that before, but since I've got a request to go through this bill section by section, maybe we should just start at the top and go through the bill.
Be so grateful.
Thank you. We want to make sure that everybody's had a chance to look at this. This is essentially the same as the Dash 1 amendment that we've already reviewed, but they've made some changes to it, and they were highlighting some of those changes. But let's start at the top, if you don't mind.
Chair Holdy, members of the committee, absolutely. As stated earlier, we are unfortunately missing our group expert who is minutes away, but we can start that. And I'll start with the first provisions of the proposed bill. This deals with foreclosure consultants. These folks typically have requested fees or other payment from the homeowner to come in and to, exactly how it sounds, consult with the homeowner and help the homeowner either avoid foreclosure or walk through the foreclosure process or even help the homeowner facilitate an equity purchase with a third party, with an equity purchaser.
And Mr. Chair, let me just jump in right here. We noted that in the definitions, Lou Savage with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we noted in the definitions on page 3 of the dash 2s, when this bill goes over to the Senate side, we may actually need to revise on line 23 of page 3, where it says a creditors committee. We may need to revise that to designate that it can be an employee as well. So that would just be a minor fix that we would need to take care of. Go ahead.
Okay, so, Mr.
Go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Okay, Mr. Chair, so I want to just be sure that is this the first time that we have ever defined foreclosure consultant?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, first time in Oregon statutes or first time with this bill?
Amazing. Thank you. I'm amazed.
First time in Oregon statutes, yes. I think he needs it. This is the first time it's statutes.
Yes, sorry, Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson. I was asking you, are you interested in the first time ever in Oregon statutes?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize.
The first time in the proposed bill.
First time in law.
The answer to that is yes.
So this is pretty monumental history that's being made.
This is, and Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, will point. I'd like to point out here that this occurs. This isn't something that has come out of the current subprime crisis or the current credit crunch. These folks are out there as well as equity purchasers. They have been off and on for many years. And so, correct, we're defining who they are and setting forth in this first portion of the bill disclosures and rights of rescission that they have to point out for consumers in writing so that consumers know exactly what they're paying for.
Committee, I'm going to ask that someone at the panel and Representative Bonamici, if you wish to assist them at some point, that's possible too. But I'd like you to just start at the very beginning, first page of the bill. Just walk through. You don't have to read the bill to us. But just kind of define what each section does. And if committee members could write down their questions on each section as we go so we can get through this, then we can come back to the questions and otherwise we'll be here all day and into the night. So I don't know how else to accomplish that other to satisfy everybody to make sure we go through this bill. So if you're able to explain section by section the bill, we'll just flip through the pages and just generally explain what each section does. You don't have to read every line and, you know, give us an interpretation of it. But
understood. Absolutely, Chair Holvey.
Thank you.
So... I will pass Section 1. It's obviously the Act statement. Section 2 defines foreclosure consultant. Section 3 removes certain licensed and regulated entities from the definition of foreclosure consultant. And as has been pointed out before, this also limits those exceptions to those folks acting under those licenses or within the scope of those licensed or regulated entities. Section 4 discusses the written foreclosure consultant contract. It also discusses the disclosures that actually need to be made to the consumer. And again, this this bill is largely a disclosure bill. The issue is that the consumers have in writing what it is that they are hiring a foreclosure consultant for and what it is that they're paying for. And as you'll see in the text, there's actually statutory forms or statutory examples that we're providing. Section 5 is a right of rescission for the homeowner. Now, with the foreclosure consultant provision, they can, Keith might have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they can rescind at any time during the foreclosure consultant contract period. Now, with that being said, we've made it clear that a foreclosure consultant who has put in certain amounts of work and performed certain duties and particularly expended funds, they, of course, have their contractual right to receive those fees and funds actually performed for the consumer under the contract at the point of rescission. You'll also see in the text that there's a second how to cancel form, a statutory form actually set out in the text of the statute. And then Section 6 is the foreclosure consultant prohibited acts. And this is important. We want to point out really quick that part of the issue with the real estate investors who testified the other day is that a foreclosure consultant cannot take an ownership interest in the property. And that, of course, the testimony by the real estate investors was problematic in the original definition of foreclosure consultant because they fell into that definition, the original definition in the bill, and they were essentially prohibited by the Act from purchasing the property despite the fact that that's their business model.
Now, Mr. Scholl, I hate to do this to you, but can you spend a little more time on Section 6 for me? Kind of identify Subsection 1, Subsection 2, so we can just identify what those are just briefly as we look through them.
Absolutely, Chair Holvey. Section 1 is receiving compensation and receiving fees from a homeowner by a foreclosure consultant unless it's actually been performed.
And these are all acts that a foreclosure consultant may not do.
Correct.
Okay.
The foreclosure consultant doesn't get paid until he's performed the act.
Okay, thank you.
The second provision deals with loans or forwarded money from a foreclosure consultant, possibly to bring payments in arrears up to present value so that they can stop the foreclosure sale, et cetera, et cetera. They can't get compensation that exceeds 9% per year in interest on those amounts that have to be repaid by the homeowner. Section 3
of 6.
Right. Sorry, subsection 3 of 6. And actually, I'm going to hand that one to Keith Carnes or Lou.
And actually, we have one of the certified smart people.
Chair Holvey, the certified smart person is here.
Mr. Ambrose, thank you for making yourself available to us yet again.
The Department of Justice is getting away.
Right. No, he's not.
Okay, good.
I'll stay.
So if the panel would like Mr. Ambrose to walk through this, we can certainly have him do that. Or if Lou, you want to go on with the.
Let me show Chris where we're at right now. We're walking through the bill, and we're on the prohibitions on Section 6.
Hey, Chris, we're doing a brief overview.
Yes, Mr. Ambrose, we just wanted to do a brief overview in Section 6 of the subsections, just, you know, a couple of words on each one without reading it.
Certainly.
Just to explain to us what these prohibited things are that a foreclosure consultant can't do.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. For the record, Chris Ambrose here on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. Section 6 in general precludes, obviously, the foreclosure consultant from taking a number of operating under a number of circumstances. First and foremost would be that it precludes the foreclosure consultant from actually being an equity purchaser as well. So from inception, if a an individual is electing to help a borrower, if you will, then they have to decide which hat they're going to wear. And I'm referring in particular to Section 6, subparagraph 5, which indicates directly or indirectly acquire an interest. So, again, if the foreclosure consultant comes forward or the potential foreclosure consultant comes forward and decides that they want to buy the property, then they can indicate we're going to save your home, we're going to take all this other action on your behalf for compensation. So. That's the primary one. The other primary one is with respect to subparagraph 3, dealing with the wage assignment. These are all, in summary, items that we had seen around the country as being potential problems with foreclosure consultants, where they would be paid claims, be able to receive assignments of wages and so on. So basically Section 6, unless there's any particular questions about them, runs through all the preclusions that are happening. Another one that was of some concern around the country was subsection 8, which deals with the power of attorney. There was some concern that homeowners were giving powers of attorneys to the equity purchaser, then the equity purchaser, for all practical purposes, was completing the transaction by himself or herself. As you might imagine, we thought that might be a problem, so the recommendation was to preclude powers of attorney.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, if that satisfies your concerns with section number 6, I'll really quick, Andrew Schilligan for the record, touch on section 7. Section 7 is the enforcement provision for violations of the foreclosure consultant requirements. Section 7 has been placed into ORS 646608 of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which I know you all are very familiar with after the Children's Product Safety Bill. This does provide the Attorney General with enforcement ability. This also does provide a private right of action for harmed homeowners, for consumers, including restitution if there's an ascertainable loss for that homeowner. It has to be a willful violation, as you are all well aware, and there are prevailing party fees. So if the defendant wins, the attorney's fees are not specific.
So there does have to be a willful intent there.
Right. The same standard under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act is there. It's the same element, willful, statutorily defined as knew or should have known that they were violating the law. And there does have to be an ascertainable loss.
Thank you.
And I would also add that there is, because we'll get into the remedy section for equity purchasers as well, there is a difference between the remedies for foreclosure consultants versus equity purchasers. The equity purchasers, the ones who actually take an interest in the home, will have more severe consequences for violation of the act. And Mr. Scholl, I'm sure, can explain it.
Absolutely. And while we're moving ahead, we will get to that provision, but I also wanted to point out, and so that we don't forestall it anymore, Section 8 is merely a reprint of ORS 646608. That's a legislative council drafting note, because the law actually changes on July 1st, 2008.
Starting with Section 9, then, we get into the equity purchaser statutes. An equity purchaser is defined at Section 9, subparagraph 3, or an equity conveyance, rather, 3A. The two components to an equity purchase are that there actually be, as you might imagine, a purchase by the homeowner to this third party, and then secondly, that there is a conveyance or an agreement to convey in one form or another via a trust, via a lease option agreement, or any other arrangement in which there's an agreement to give back the homeowner the ownership of the property pursuant to this agreement. So it does not, there had been some misunderstanding out there about just outright sales. Let's say somebody approaches a homeowner to buy their house, and that person may be in foreclosure. If they simply buy the house, a third-party transaction, they don't come forward and qualify as a foreclosure consultant, so assuming they're not coming in there for compensation, then that's not necessarily precluded. So, the balance of Section 9 pertains to the definitions, equity seller, equity purchaser, of course, settlement agent, which I'll discuss in just a moment. Section 10 is the exemptions, which is, as you can see, dramatically less than the exemptions for foreclosure consultants. For example, it doesn't allow an attorney, even if the attorney is acting under their license, to be an equity purchaser. Or I should say, it allows them to be an equity purchaser. They just still have to qualify and comply with all the other requirements. Same thing with any other licensee who may otherwise may be exempt under the, as a foreclosure consultant is not exempt here. There are a few that make sense. Number one, for example, a deed in lieu of foreclosure. If the lender is taking back the property, then that lender is going to be exempt. Creditors committee of bankruptcy, and then there was an extensive discussion about the families. The task force didn't necessarily want to preclude other family members from helping out, for example, a parent helping out a child or vice versa, and having them come under the statute this way. So those are the limited exceptions. Section 11 pertains to the primary requirements for a written contract. Along with cancellation rights, the homeowner has the right to essentially cancel the contract subject to repayment for any amount that they may have borrowed. For example, if the equity purchaser provides them with a short-term loan, then that homeowner is going to be required to repay that subject to a cap of 9%. So the contract also is an attempt to be in plain language as much as possible. I know that Representative Bonamici in particular drafted up the bulk of the notice provisions or the cancellation provisions in an attempt to keep it as straightforward as possible to the homeowner. The intent also is to enable the homeowner to have enough information that if they do elect to cancel, that they're going to be able to send it to the right person. So that's set forth in the notice required by Oregon law provision that's set forth on page 23. There also is a requirement that the equity purchase be conducted by a settlement agent. This was an attempt to preclude homeowners and equity purchasers from simply having the kitchen table conversations in which the equity purchaser, through a sales pitch or whatever, convinces the homeowner to go ahead and sell the property and sign it over at that particular point in time. So a couple provisions that are intended to preclude that. One would be that the contract has to be provided 24 hours in advance, and secondly, it has to be handled by a qualified settlement agent, which is defined in the sections as including title and escrow companies, licensed attorneys, and I believe there may be one other. Section 12 deals with the cancellation provisions. As it indicates at Section 12, and I'm looking at page 24 now, Section 12, midnight of the third business day after the equity seller signs a document purporting to transfer an interest in the residence in foreclosure or a foreclosure sale of the residence. There was a lot of discussions and working with the title companies, among other individuals, to come up with the best means possible to make sure that the cancellation is not going to occur in a manner that is going to hinder title insurance from being obtained. So that's why it's midnight of the third day. And then there also is a laying out in on page 25 is the procedures under which they must follow in order to comply with the cancellation provisions. And then there also is a provision, again, dealing with, and I'm looking at page 25, section 5, dealing with the requirement that they pay back, the homeowner pay back any funds that they may have borrowed from the potential equity purchaser if they cancel within 60 days and under a maximum of 9% interest. So, again, that addresses those circumstances where, for example, the equity purchaser, in order to buy some time, may loan the or provide the homeowner with some funds, and that any of those funds would have to be repaid within 60 days after the cancellation to a maximum or with a maximum of 9% interest. Pages 26 and 27, unless there are any particular questions, these deal with the particular means for cancellation. Again, we've tried to keep it in simple language as much as possible, in plain language as much as possible.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
We're 27 pages through 37, and I wanted just to have a quick check-in with my plain language official. How are we doing on plain language? Okay.
Excellent.
Thanks for the pause.
I don't think we should use anything beyond a two-syllable word, though.
Mr. Ambrose, I didn't mean to break your concentration. I apologize for the committee. Please continue.
Well, others may disagree with the statute being plain language, but hopefully the means of cancellation is in plain language. Section 13 has some very important provisions. By way of background, the intent is to not set up the homeowner for failure. So if the homeowner, there is an equity purchase, and the homeowner enters into, let's say, a leaseback arrangement of some kind, if the homeowner can't meet the lease payments and defaults right away, that somewhat defeats the purpose of the equity purchase. So there is a provision at Section 13, 1AA, page 28, at the top of page 28, verify and be able to demonstrate that the equity seller, the homeowner that is, has or will have a reasonable ability to pay for the subsequent reconveyance of the residential real property. And then B also deals with the reasonable ability to meet the lease payments. If this works the way I believe everybody thinks it should work, there then would be an obligation on the part of the equity purchaser to determine not only whether the lease payments can be made, but also whether or not the homeowner is going to have a reasonable ability to pay or to exercise the option and purchase the house back. So if 18 months after the lease option is entered into, for example, it does not appear likely that the homeowner is going to be able to, well, that's by way of example. If the purchase price, for example, is $150,000 and the exercise price to purchase the house back is $250,000 and the homeowner is having difficulty or is likely to have difficulty being able to exercise to meet his or her monthly obligations and then also to come up with $250,000 18 months after the lease option, then that would not be in compliance with this agreement. So there's got to be an analysis done by the homeowner and more particularly the equity purchaser at the time that they enter into the lease agreement to enable the homeowner to have not absolute ability, but a reasonable ability to A, meet the lease payments, and B, exercise the option in the future.
Mr. Ambrose, is that something that is the industry does periodically? It seems we're having the equity purchaser verify a reasonable ability to pay for the subsequent reconveyance. So is that something that's established in industry practice?
Some do, and certainly some don't. Some, I would say, do basically set it up for failure on the part of the homeowner such that there's no reasonable ability for the homeowner to be able to get the property back.
Hmm. Seems like a good lending practice. Thank you.
And
what is pardon me. Can we ask questions?
Hmm?
May we ask questions?
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Ambrose. So where does the proof lie that you did that?
Ultimately, the proof will come forward in the nature of the transaction itself. And one other component, for example, is that the laws of dealing with equitable mortgages are not thrown out the door either. That's set forth, I forget the exact section, but towards the end, it's made clear, Section 15, that equitable mortgages are not out the door as well. So is there some provision that precludes or require some kind of proof level other than what the statute says? I would say there's nothing unless somebody else has any other idea. I guess when all is said and done, if the contract doesn't comply and somebody comes forward and there is not an analysis done by the purchaser that there was some analysis done regarding the ability to pay, then that purchaser would not be in compliance.
And Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, really quick, and I know Keith Carnes can speak to this as well. Unfortunately, what we see are the lease buyback agreements where the lease terms, the rental terms by the homeowner, are actually an equal or higher payment to what the mortgage payment was. And so it's self-serving evidence that if they're in foreclosure because they can't make their mortgage payments, they can't make that equal or greater payment in a monthly rental payment, let alone buy the property back in 24 months.
Thank you. Go ahead. I'll try to keep from interrupting you again until we get done.
And Chair Holby and Representative Nelson, I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it sections A and B do require that the equity purchaser conduct that analysis, so that's what the statute
And do I have? I just want to know if I have to verify that they did. I'm the seller, and do I have to swear that you did that?
I don't believe we have that written in that there's that requirement. I would have to think if I am the equity purchaser that I am. If I'm the equity purchaser, then I would require that the equity seller give me some indication that that analysis has been conducted.
Just for protection.
Thank you. Would you?
Sorry.
Keep going if you can. Try to get through the rest of this.
Section 13 at the bottom E deals with the recapture. This is, I guess, in sections 13 and 14 would be one of the primary aspects. Section 13 deals with it was originally called net proceeds. It's now called the equity recapture payment. The principle behind that is that within a limited period of time, namely 24 months, if the equity purchaser purchases the property and then sells it as a result of the homeowner has failed to exercise the lease option, then the equity purchaser would have to provide 82% of the quote-unquote equity recapture proceeds back to the homeowner. So by way of example, if there's an 18-month lease option, for example, and the homeowner doesn't exercise the option and then the equity purchaser decides to go ahead and flip the property and just sell it, within 2 years, then the equity purchaser would have to share a portion of the equity, the the net proceeds for all practical purposes. We were reluctant, and there was a lot of discussion about net proceeds. The reason we didn't go with net proceeds is that's somewhat of a term of art, and the equity recapture payment, which is defined in the statute, primarily deals with an exclusion for things that the homeowner or the seller incurs him or herself. So if, for example, the homeowner has a judgment lien against the property, then that would be deducted in determining what the equity recapture payment should be. If, on the other hand, the purchaser goes out there and gets a second line of credit, for example, and has a lien against the property, then he or her is not going to be able to deduct that in determining the net proceeds. Section 14 deals with a memorandum of agreement primarily, and that is an attempt to make sure that there's something recorded against the property so that anybody buying the property would not be, by and large, deemed a bona fide purchaser and the would have some obligation to the homeowner if they knew about it. And I believe Mr. Scholl is going to address sections 15 and thereafter.
Chair Holder, members of the committee, again, Andrew Scholl. Section 15, Chris already alluded to it. This is the what's now been deemed the Mr. Knox provision, poor Mr. Knox, for those of you who heard the testimony. But one of the things his lawyer was successful in doing was getting it deemed an equitable mortgage. This is essentially a common law provision that that protects the person. It says there's a mortgage, even though there's not a piece of paper that says there is a mortgage. And Representative Bonamici brought up yesterday that Section 15 is the provision that specifies this does not change equitable mortgage law as it stands today in Oregon. Section 16, this was what was also alluded to in the difference in enforcement. The equity purchaser provisions of this bill are enforced by the Attorney General or District Attorneys through ORA 646-607. This is still part of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but it does not include the private right of action provision in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and that is because Section 17 is an independent private right of action that, for lack of a better term, provides additional tools and a more effective private right of action under the context of equity purchasers, since we're essentially talking about the largest investment that people make for their personal use. We're essentially talking about that being taken away. So there are some damages that go beyond what possibly the Unlawful Trade Practices Act could offer, and there is also a different attorney fees provision, and actually I will let Keith Carnes discuss the attorney fees provision.
The attorney fees provision is one that was patterned after federal law, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The attorney fees, if the home, if the original homeowner who went into foreclosure, the equity seller, prevails, then they get their attorney fees paid by the defendant in the case. If the if the equity seller fails to win in court, the way that the court would allow attorney fees to the defendant would be if the court finds that the lawsuit was brought in bad faith or for the purpose of harassment. So if the court finds that, you know, there was no claim whatsoever, this was brought for harassment, you were angry that the deal went bad or whatever, then the court could make the equity buyer, I'm sorry, the equity seller pay the equity buyer's attorney fees. However, the equity seller only needs to prevail to have their attorney fees paid, and that's patterned after the federal cause of action that exists.
Mr. Chair, can I add, there's also one more difference in recognizing the more serious nature of the loss in an equity conveyance. There's a longer statute of limitations than under the Unfair Trade Practices, Unlawful Trade Practices Act has a short statute of limitations. We've given this one a six-year statute of limitations, which is the basic contract statute of limitations.
And Chair Holby, as Representative Bonamici noted, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act is substantially shorter. It's a one-year statute of limitations for the private right of action. Section 18, again, under the impression that this is dealing with the largest individual purchase that a person may make their home. Section 18 is a provision that makes certain violations of the equity purchaser provisions of this law a misdemeanor, punishable by not more than 1 year's imprisonment and a fine of not more than $10,000 or both. And then I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Ambrose and Lou Savage.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, again, Lou Savage with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Up until now, the bill has dealt with foreclosure consultants and equity purchasers. This is really a new topic starting on Section 19, and it deals with the foreclosure notice. Currently, under Oregon law, the notice of sale is required to be sent to the homeowner. The problem is it is very confusing, and often homeowners really don't understand what their rights are and what kinds of options they may have available. So what this bill does is require, under Oregon law, a very clear notice to the homeowner as to what their rights are and what their options may be. The notice itself, which starts on page 33 and then on to 34, has some specific requirements that are helpful in terms of language and an explanation to the homeowner. For example, the second paragraph, starting on line 7, in very clear language says that your lender has decided to sell this property because the money due on your mortgage loan has not been paid. In very clear language, so the homeowner understands why they're getting this notice. The third paragraph in this notice tells the homeowner what the amount that they would have to pay as of a certain date to bring the mortgage loan current, and gives that dollar amount. We have added since the last draft this next sentence: the amount you must pay to bring your loan current may have increased since that date, and that's in response to the concern that the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar had that this amount changes over time because interest and other fees increase if depending upon when you would actually make that payment. The fourth paragraph gives a specific phone number to the homeowner, which will give them the number that they can call to find out the exact amount that they owe, because again that number may be changing and will be changing over the course of time. On page 35 of the amendment, on line 8, we actually give a let's see, I guess we did not fix that, did we? Actually, did we decide?
That was a different change where we changed the name.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to make sure that we hadn't overlooked something in our last amendment. It gives a name, but not the name of a particular person. It would be the lender. We'd have that name and the phone number that the homeowner can call. The paragraph starting on line 14 is very valuable to the homeowner because it actually gives the homeowner some resources that they can use to give them some assistance in terms of consultation and possibly some legal assistance if that's what's needed. The warning on line 26 really does key back to the earlier sections of the bill, because what we don't want to happen is a homeowner who is in foreclosure get tied up with the very foreclosure consultants that we are worried about in the earlier sections of the bill. On line 9 of page 36 of the amendment, the Department of Consumer and Business Services is given the authority to adopt rules to specify the format, font size, and other characteristics of the notice, and also certain other aspects of the notice which may change over time. The other significant piece of this this portion of the bill is section 21, which links this notice to the homeowner with the rest of the requirements that a trustee must comply with under the law, which means that if this notice is not sent along with the other required documents, the foreclosure would basically have to start over again. So there's a real consequence to not complying with this section. We were worried that if there was not that link to the other requirements, that there may be some folks who don't actually send a notice.
That's good.
That, I think, those are the major portions of the bill. The section 22 and 23 really speak to the implementation of the bill itself. And I guess that would be it. If members of the committee have other questions, any number of us, I hope we can answer them.
Questions, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much. Back to the issue, gentlemen, that I've discussed and brought up because it makes me so dang mad about my Hispanic people in my district that lost everything they saved for years and years in McMinnville, Newburg. Something, I think there needs to be a language issue because they clearly did not understand language. So somewhere in here it needs to be understandable language. I mean, if that was ever important, it really is important now.
May I respond to that, Mr. Chair?
Representative
Nelson, the notices are required to be written in the language that's spoken by the homeowner and used in discussions between the homeowner and, for example, the foreclosure consultant.
Where is that?
That's on page 4, lines 7 through 11 for the foreclosure consultants, and I sure hope it's in the other part, too.
I hope it is, too.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson, you raised a good point, and I think that's something that we could fix on the side. Have similar language on the foreclosure notice itself.
I'm for the equity conveyance. It's on page 22, lines 4 through 8.
Where? 22,
line 4.
Oh, line 4. Okay, cool.
Okay, so then, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So then, in a court of law, help me, what prevails? The Hispanic, in this case, I'm not just talking, it just happens to be these individuals. The Hispanic translation or the English?
Ultimately, it would...
English is what I heard. I call last term.
It gets fairly convoluted, but my understanding at least is that you would take into consideration all of the terms in the contract, including primarily what's been provided to the homeowner. So if, for example, the only documentation that has been provided to the homeowner is a Spanish language document, a written contract, which is what they would be required to do here, then any court interpreting that would take that into consideration, and ultimately you have to call in a language expert to deal with whether or not there's enough of a difference between the Spanish language version and the English version, for example, to cause any type of ambiguity, and then the appeal would be up to the courts to determine thereafter.
Well, would the, pardon me, Mr. Chair, but would the home seller, homeowner, would his language prevail? Because he's the one, he's about to be the biggest loser.
Well, if there's any difference between, I mean, for example, if there's a provision that's left out, then certainly the homeowner would prevail on that and using the Spanish language version. If there's a difference of interpretation, then there possibly would be the possibility of ambiguity that the court would have to determine.
And may I have one quick question? Why did y'all determine to pay somebody three times? I lost my page. You know where I'm talking about? Let's see. That page 33, line 6. I just wonder, is this a usual thing? I mean, is this in other states?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, yes, it is in other states. In the other states have adopted this. We did this in lieu of punitive damages under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The court has the option of assessing punitive damages. In this case, rather than setting punitive damages, we're fixing treble damages. This is used in Washington State under the Consumer Protection Act, and many other states do this, yes.
Okay, so no punitive damages may be...
No, well, some... Punitive damages are sometimes referred to as treble damages. I mean, sometimes they're used interchangeably. But in lieu of the UTPA's language of punitive damages, we've decided to use the three times the amount of actual damages as the way of assessing a punitive type of damage.
Okay.
Thank you. Further questions?
Quick question, Mr.
Chairman. Representative Gilliam.
Representative Nelson, it's through.
Do you have another question, Representative?
Yes, I just was going to finish on that page. So, when you go down to 14, I was amazed. Of course, I've never been in real estate. Probably a good thing. The 6 years, is that a norm? Is that a usual that we have a 6-year statute?
Chairman, Representative Nelson. A 6-year statute of limitations is common contract law, and so to the extent that we are looking at this as a contractual agreement, we use the 6-year statute.
Representative Gilliam, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just a quick comment
not
on
Speaker yet.
What did I say, Mr. Speaker?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the language, like I was looking on 4, and I appreciate the sensitivity to the language.
Is it a page 4 or line 4?
Page 4. And I think we should probably be. It says line 7. I have trouble with the word spoken and. If we can fix this on the Senate side, that's fine with me, but I think there are issues. It's confusing to me. Homeowner. That was spoken to the homeowner, and that was it. Could be or. Is it the language that he or she is fluent in? I think we're trying to be sensitive, but I don't think it's clear. And then the other question I have is on page 4. If this is standard language, I understand. But down here, on page 4, line 30, it says you should contact an attorney or other professional advisor. If you go to page 35 in another warning, you say she talked to a lawyer, and that may or may not need to be consistent. And again, it's not substantive, and if you want to do that in the Senate, that's fine with me.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam, I can't remember all of the intricacies of the discussions, but I would venture to guess that the foreclosure consultant, we put in professional advisor, but on the notice, because somebody's actually in foreclosure, we thought it would be more important to get actual legal counseling. Yeah.
To steer them more directly to my favorite profession.
Good.
What about attorney-lawyer? Interchangeable? But
definitely.
Okay.
Where did you see that last one, please? Where did you say contact a lawyer?
Page 35, line 18.
No. In that, Mr. Chair, in that small discussion, if I might,
Representative Riley.
Thank you. I believe that lawyer is preferable to attorney in plain language.
Fewer syllables. Good.
Make a note. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee?
On everything? Sorry. Mr. Chair, meant on those sections or just on the whole amendment?
Do you have any other questions?
I think I might.
I do, Mr. Chair.
The meaning of life.
On page 34.
No, I didn't mean that either.
I mean, much of this bill, you know, we've looked at and had plenty of time, but page 4, Representative Nelson.
34.
Page 34, I thought line 12, it should, I marked out the amount you have to pay is blank, not would have had to and was. I think it is what is due today.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, the issue is that these amounts literally change on a daily basis, and so since these are mailed out, you know, even if it takes a day to mail, it's going to be past tense, and the foreclosure costs are being added one at a time to have these served, to have it published in a newspaper of general circulation, and there's all these steps that have to happen, and so we wanted to make it clear that you can't just tender the amount that's listed on this here. That's a past tense amount. It's a good get. It's a very close to what you need to pay, but that is not an amount that you can pay today and bring your loan current.
So what it really should say, Mr. Chair, follow-up, is it is estimated the amount so-and-so you would have to pay. Because I'm just worried because we're going to put something there, and then when they find a way to get out all of a sudden, they're really going to have to pay X.
Chair Holby.
More.
I bought it. Chair Holby, Representative Nelson. There's actually a lot of litigation in the federal courts about using estimates when you're trying to collect debts. There's actually a case out of the Fifth Circuit that is Miller versus McCullen Raymer, where somebody who did this exact thing and put in estimates ended up being sued. And so an estimate may not work under federal law. And so certainly I don't think this is magic language that we've developed here that is, you know, anywise perfect, but estimate probably would trigger some issues with the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
So follow up, Mr. Chair. So really, what we don't even need that. I mean, that first line we should really leave out and say, the amount you must now pay to bring your loan current may have increased since when? Since we last did what?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, the foreclosure happens 120 days after this notice goes out. And so what we're trying to convey to them is that, you know, if they're 3 months behind and their payment's $1,000, then it's $3,000 plus some late fees and some other costs that are involved. So, say, you know, you would have to have paid $3,500 as of yesterday to bring this loan current. We don't want them sending in a check for $3,500 2 weeks later, because then they won't get it done. The lender will literally send it back and say, now you owe us $3,540. And so we want them to call, and that's why we put on the notice, you know, call and get the number. And, you know, if you call them or if you write the trustee, they have to give you the exact amount that'll bring it current. But this gets them a place to start asking mom and dad, saying, hey, you know, I'm $3,500 short. Can you loan me some money?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Galizio,
I didn't mean to shout.
Sorry.
Didn't realize I was so close.
I was not asleep.
Okay. I was getting there. So, correct me if I'm wrong, we're not legislative counsel, and I appreciate the desire that we all have to be editors, but my understanding is what we're trying to do is we're really focusing on these key issues and making sure that this amendment takes care of that which we were concerned, and it seems to do that, and I don't know that our job is to wordsmith, so are we going to vote on this in the near future?
We may.
Okay.
I hope not today. We just got it.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, part of the concern with taking that completely out is consumers may know their monthly payments, and they may know that they haven't paid in several months, but they may not have any idea of how far gone it is. So that number, even though it is essentially old by the time the consumer gets it, and it will be a higher number for all intents and purposes, it's important in this notice to let the consumer know approximately where their standing is, and that's the best number for that approximation. As Keith pointed out, they may know that they're paying $1,000 a month, but they may have no idea that the total with fees and everything else at the mailing of the letter is $4,500.
And just to add to what Andrew said, the real balance here with this notice is to provide the homeowner enough information that they can make some informed decisions and have the kind of the critical information. But the problem is the more information you put on the notice, the more unreadable it is and the less likely they are to actually understand it. So that's what we tried to achieve that balance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, respond to the question that Representative Galizio asked about voting on this. We've had several hours of explanation of the bill, and yesterday, before we had the Dash 2 Amendment, we did get an explanation of the areas where the Dash 2 Amendment would be addressed. And I can say confidently that those areas have been addressed in the Dash 2 Amendment, and the Dash 1 Amendment we've had for several days, and there were just a few areas. The brief definition of foreclosure consultant to make sure we're dealing with the investor issue, the net proceeds, which is now redemption and, or what is it called?
Recapture.
And the change on the notice. Those small areas were discussed yesterday, and now we have the amendment before us, and I feel confident that the amendment accurately reflects, the testimony that was given yesterday and the discussions that we've already had.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. Mr. Savage, as the governor's task force in convening this overall group and having vetted this issue widely amongst industry, can you tell me if the industry amongst this in this work group is in support of the Dash 2 amendments?
Yes, they are, and the thing that we really tried to achieve is even when we had subcommittees or small groups, we had a group that was composed of both industry and consumer advocates, so that all points of view were represented, and so I'm confident that what you see before you today is supported by the work group, by industry and consumers alike.
And we have a long list of who makes up that work group as well.
Yes, I believe we provided that to you last time with the testimony.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to assure my colleagues that whatever level of enjoyment they're getting out of this, mine is slightly less. And I just have a question on page 28. A simple question. I haven't been through this type of document before. Why 82% on lines 28, 29?
I marked that too.
82%, Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam, was a number that started a number of years ago with statutes that we've looked at for comparison. This statute is certainly not identical to any statutes, but we've tried to, the task force has tried to pick and choose and improve upon areas that had been left out in other statutes. There's an entity called the Center for Policy Initiatives. New Hampshire and a few other states have used the 82% number, and that was based on what ultimately was concluded to be a fair number based on after you take out all of the closing costs and so on. It could be 80%, 84%. I couldn't get a definitive answer to say that 82% is perfect, but it was a rough estimate.
Follow up on that page.
Follow up.
I appreciate that answer. And then if you go back up to 13, Representative Nelson asked a question about sort of putting the teeth into that section, B, subsection B, 11 through. Did we resolve that? I was unsure about that. Does everybody feel like that's resolved from that question? I didn't think it was.
There is, Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam, I'm not sure if I don't believe there's anything else in the statute other than that if there is a challenge to the equity purchase contract and the equity purchaser is unable to show that they conducted that analysis, then they're going to have problems with the statute. There also, I might add, is with respect to conducting the analysis, we did, and I neglected to mention this the last time, there is on the next page, section 14, try to build in a safe harbor for equity purchasers so that they're not randomly figuring out what is reasonable or not. So at least with respect to the monthly payments, the safe harbor is 60% of gross monthly income, that the lease payments may not exceed 60% of the gross monthly income for the homeowner. So we tried to compromise to make sure that an equity purchaser can conduct their analysis and come up with the person's gross monthly income and make a determination on whether or not they can basically afford those payments, those monthly payments or not, based on that 60% threshold.
And, Mr. Chair, I have what I believe be my last question, if you will.
Before you do, could I touch on that point, if I may, Mr. Chair?
Representative Riley.
Thank you. I happen to agree with Representative Nelson and Gilliam that that particular point needs a little more in it, and I would recommend that you look at something that possibly the homeowner signs at the time that analysis is done, to say that analysis has been performed, and put that in the Senate, possibly. That's just a recommendation.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to add there's a bit of a converse provision on page 30, section 14, paragraph B, that there's also a presumption that the equity purchaser has failed to verify that the equity seller hasn't a reasonable ability to pay for a subsequent reconveyance if the equity purchaser has not obtained supporting documents other than a statement by the equity seller of assets, liability, and income. So that's another obligation there that the equity purchaser has to verify, and they can't just rely on the equity seller saying, I'm going to be able to pay for this. And that's on page 30 as well.
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, that stems from, in part at least, from we've all heard of these stated income loans, and where the homeowner simply states what they're making, which turns out may not always be reliable. If, on the other hand, the equity purchaser knows that what the homeowner is representing is not in fact true, based on any other documentation that they've received, then the equity purchaser is going to have problems.
For both sides of that being covered by
money. I
agree.
So I sense that there are some on this committee that are not comfortable moving this bill at this time. Was anybody voicing that?
I had one more question.
How many more one more?
No, well, I didn't get nobody gave it to me.
Yeah, he didn't get it.
So go ahead, Representative Gilliam. One more question.
Thank you. I yielded to Representative Riley. I'm glad I did, but I had another question. Now, I want to make everybody at ease here. I would like a brief answer to this question. I am not trying to open up a whole can of worms, and part of the reason for that is I am comforted in Representative Bonamici's statement about her confidence in Dash 2s. So if you would, just go back for a second. We had some trouble, you alluded to it, with the private right of action. Different bill. This is a different bill. It's apples and oranges. But I would just like a little bit of assurance that there is truly a need, in this case, for the additional word language about private right of action for this bill.
Chair Holy, Representative Gilliam, first of all, I'd like to preface that with the private right of action contained in the first provision of this bill is something that's been vetted with the larger mortgage lending work group. Second of all, here, as in the last case, it is needed, and the reason that it's very prominent for this bill is simply the fact that some of these are opportunist situations. So there may not be a pattern of victims. There may not be a truly actionable set of circumstances and conduct for the Attorney General. And so this allows somebody who's been taken at a bad time in their life to enforce the provisions of this statute, these disclosure provisions that are set forth.
Thank you.
Where is that on the first page?
Chair Holder, Representative Nelson.
Yes, I couldn't find that. I wanted to know where that was. I thought you said it's on the first page.
Oh, sorry. No, I was referencing a previous bill.
In the previous case.
So is that in this bill?
Yes. Can I answer, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, there's a private right of action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act for violation of the foreclosure consultant section. Then there's a separate right of action outside of the, that's not within the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, for the equity purchase, because that's when somebody's really at a serious risk of losing their home. They're likely to lose their home. So that we took that one out of unlawful trade practices, but the foreclosure consultant is within the unlawful trade practices. So that has a one-year statute of limitations, and they have to show an ascertainable loss and willful conduct.
And thank you. Excuse me. I'm going to carry this bill over till Monday because it's obvious that some are not comfortable with this bill at this point. So you have time over the weekend to look at these pieces and hopefully get your answers on Monday and or potentially over the weekend. I know the industry has spent a great deal of time and is in support of this bill, but I want to make sure we have time to deal with it. So we will bring it back on Monday, Representative Nelson, so we can finish this up. Our committee is run over time now, and we have another committee coming in. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3630.